Hello and welcome to this episode of the Mega Game Assembly podcast. My name's Harrison. I'd like to thank you very much from the bottom of my heart for downloading this episode. It's a fantastic episode. We are joined by Tony from the Dukes of Highland Gaming Group to talk to you about the logistics of going from having never played a Mega Game to running a group, running games at a con, and modifying a game design all for your very own uses. It's a really interesting conversation and I hope you'll learn a lot from it. So without further ado, here we go. So I'm now joined by Tony from the Dukes of Highland, which is a gaming group, and I'm going to most definitely get this wrong, in Louisville, Kentucky. How was that?
Perfect. Well done.
Oh my goodness. Wow. Okay. So normally I would ask you to introduce yourself by telling us about your history of Mega Gaming, but that's basically going to be our episode this evening. So do you want to give me a brief history of who you are and how you've ended up where you are? And we'll just sort of ignore Mega Gaming stuff for the time being.
Sure. My name is Tony. I am originally from the UK, originally from Cheshire. I am now living in Louisville, Kentucky, which is spelt Louisville for any Brits out there. I married an American girl about 15 years ago and moved over here. And I've been a gamer since before I can remember. And Mega Games were a natural extension of that. But we'll talk about that more in a moment.
Fantastic. Okay, great. So how did you first hear about Mega Games? When was the first time you heard that term?
The term, that is an interesting question. The term, of course, I heard the same way that everybody hears that term, and that is from the Watch the Skies video done by the Shut Up and Sit Down boys. However, I think that I have been Mega Gaming longer than that, because there are a number of things in my history that have, you know, you can look back at and say, oh, that was definitely a Mega Game. So a couple that jump out at me are the Murder Mystery Party games, which are kind of LARP and Mega Game adjacent. Been doing those for a couple of decades now. When I did my MBA a few years ago, we had this class and we played a Mega Game in it. It was an online portal to this business simulation. And we were in teams of four or five, and we all had our own startup business, and we were competing against each other. And we had to log on every 3 days or something, plug in a bunch of inputs, buy things, sell things, build our warehouse or whatever. And then the game would resolve every 3 days and we would log on, see what we were doing, and then and communicate with our neighbors and that kind of stuff. So that was absolutely a Mega Game, although I did not know it at the time.
That most definitely sounds like a Mega Game to me.
There are others that in my history that I might remember as we move on, but those are the ones that really stick out in my mind as definite Mega Games.
Fantastic. So you watched that Watch the Skies video and you thought to yourself, wait a minute.
I thought, it's very sad that I'm now in the US and there is so little Mega Gaming over here. But I did find some, and that was at Gen Con in about 2017 or 18, I forget now. And I played Watch the Skies as a deputy head of state for India and had a wonderful experience. But came away from that thinking, man, I didn't do enough stuff. You know, it's the age old adage where, man, you just need to say yes to this and you just need to go for it. So the next year at Gen Con, I went back and played Den of Wolves. And I was given the opportunity about halfway through the game to convert to the Wolf team. I was the captain of the Salvador, which is the medical ship. And I looked over at my fellow player and said, this is a really good opportunity. And I know it sounds like we're going to betray everybody here, but this is the moment that makes the Mega Game for us. And it was a wonderful experience. It was fabulous. Anyway, of course, then I bought a copy of Watch the Skies and bits and pieces, and I wanted to run it, and I just kept putting it off. And then coming out of the pandemic, I convinced a bunch of my friends to come along for the ride. I basically did it as a solo project because I'm an organizer. I'm a kind of a project manager by trade, so it's something I could do. It's in my skill set. And convinced my friends to be my control team and do a little logistical stuff. But mostly I set up a local game group from scratch and ran the converted version of Watch the Skies in March of this year. And it was fabulous. Had an amazing time. Yeah.
Incredible. So you went from accidentally playing in Mega Games for very many years to hearing about Mega Games to going along and playing in a couple of Mega Games and having such a good time, you decided the next logical step was to put on a game yourself and mod it all in one. But I suppose you've basically been training for that for the past however many years.
Yes. So the modding decision was an interesting one. So I've kind of blogged about my experience on our website, which is the dukesofhighland.net. I ended up modding it because I felt like there were holes in the rules. And I'm someone that is sort of I don't like the term rules lawyer, but if it's not written down and there's not guidance, then I'm going to struggle with it, especially never having controlled Watch the Skies before. So I didn't really know what went into running a mega game. So yeah. Once I got hold of the rules, I was like, man, I just don't know how to run this. So I kind of did some redesign for a few reasons. One was, of course, to fill the gaps in my knowledge, and two was just to give it, you know, my own personal flair, really. And so that whole experience of redesigning and running it is all on my blog, if that's something that'd be interesting to read.
Well, if it, we'll do a light gloss over now, and yeah, I will put a link to in the podcast to for the full shebang. So what were the biggest modifications you made, and if there's a particular reason for doing them?
Well, science game, of course. That's the one that most people have a dig at, from what I understand. And that was because someone told me once upon a time that the original science game was supposed to represent like a unseen university Discworld or something Monty Python-ish. And that makes total sense coming from the mind of a Brit. I could totally see that. But for me and for my audience, I wasn't sure the farcical would work quite as well. And it just wasn't something that was super interesting to me. It seems like the theme of Watch the Skies is much more, you know, in quotes, realistic. How do the Earth's governments react to something like this? So I don't expect the scientists to start working out what kind of silly hats the aliens wear. So, you know, and for my particular audience, which is here in Louisville, we ran the first mega game. I knew that nobody else had done one before. So my audience is going to be gamers, not necessarily LARPers or farcical Brits. So we created a tech tree, and we turn it into like a bidding game whereby people would bid on components and they would use those to go up the tech tree, and those technologies would be used in other areas of the game. So it sort of connected the science game to the rest of the game a little closer too.
Sure. And so was your concern the free-form nature of the rules that existed, or was it more the farcical nature of it, or was it a kind of a combination?
Yeah, definitely a combination. The freeform rules is something that, as a new organizer and runner, is very hard to know what it's going to look like in practice. If I'd have been in the UK and helped control a game of Watch the Skies, my experience would have been very different going into this. I would have known how to run it. But because I did not have that experience, to me, it looked very disjointed on a piece of paper. Like, I don't know how to run this. There's a lot of unsaid things in this documentation. So that was my main driving force for that.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I suppose the writing of those rules was probably never done with the thought of this is probably going to be read by someone who has no actual experience of the game. Mm-hmm. I suppose that's probably a fairly unusual thing for Jim Warman to have been thinking about when he wrote those rules.
So. Absolutely, yeah, and I've heard that many times since, and in fact, and we'll talk about this probably towards the end of the podcast, but I've got an idea on how to make mega games in general easier to run, but we'll get there later. Yeah,
well, that sounds revolutionary. You'll have to stay tuned if you want that that exciting content at the end there. Okay, so you put your own spin on the science game. Mm-hmm. Where else did you?
We tweaked a few of the UN events. Thought we had some, you know, a friend of mine and I, we listened to the news, and we're based in the US, and things had changed a lot since it was originally written, so we had some good ideas for some new things. So we had like an Australian denial of service attack that was really interesting. We also realized that the resolution of the last round of the game didn't have any meaning, because most of the resolution of the UN game is done the turn after. And when it's the last turn, you don't have that turn after. So we created a whole event for that last one. We did well, spoilers here, but we did a bomb threat. We had a made-up organization who decided that they hated aliens and wanted us to cut all contact and ties with the aliens, and therefore had planted bombs in the United Nations. And so while the folks that were playing thought they were there for a climate summit, we kind of dropped this sort of ransom note in the middle of the table and said, hey, you've got to sort this problem out. And you know, just makes for, it's sort of like forced last turn madness in a lot of ways. Forced is the wrong word.
You could say you dropped a bit of a bombshell on that.
There you go, yes, yeah. Force is definitely the wrong word. It was more of a plot point, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they could have ignored the bomb if they wanted to.
Well, that's it. We told them if they opened the door, they were going to have trouble. But they definitely were inclined. It was really fun to watch the frantic text messages when we told them that they couldn't leave the room, like to their heads of state. So the heads of state, they're all kind of stood around, kind of twiddling their thumbs, and you know, everybody's phones are blowing up because the ambassadors are all locked away somewhere. So that was really fun.
That would ruffle some feathers, I'm sure. So you had a prepared last turn. You knew ahead of time when you were going to end the game, because that's another possible option that a lot of people use for Watch the Skies, that they keep the last turn a little bit fluid to try and avoid last turn madness. It never works, but that's the theory.
Yeah, well, you know, last turn madness, the argument there, of course, is do you embrace it or do you, you know, put bumpers around it? And for the UN game, we sort of had to give them a reason to do something interesting because there was none. And the same with the science game. Like if you've got a tech tree and you're working on technologies, well, those technologies aren't going to get to be used. So kind of on the fly, really, our science control guy said, we're going to have nothing to do here. So, you know, how do you feel about me saying that there is people are getting brainwashed by the aliens and see if the scientists can solve it? I'm like, oh my gosh, that sounds so good. You know, he just took the initiative and just ran with it, really. So he just turned the whole last turn of the science game into something that was worthwhile too. Because remember, the audience have never played a mega game before. And most of them, probably, I would say 80% of them, never even heard of a mega game before. Because it's such a new concept outside of, you know, this tiny niche group that we are online.
For sure.
So,
as a possible tangent here, how did you sell it to your audience? Your audience of, as you say, mostly board gamers who'd never even heard the term mega game.
Well, now we're getting into how do you build a mega game group from the ground up, and it's a topic I'm very passionate about, and we'll talk about this more in detail later. But
fantastic.
Essentially, it boils down to finding those communities and pitching the idea to them over and over again, and then convincing all your gamer friends that you know and all their gamer friends that they know to come along for this ride. So you have to set your price point as low as you can get away with. You have to find all the communities and all your friends and all their friends of friends. And then you have to advertise to them over and over again as this amazing experience, all-day event, game at once in a lifetime, gamers kind of thing. And particularly, we were right off the back of the Omicron wave. So, you know, we're at this...
That's a tricky time.
Yeah, it was. But it sort of worked in our favor in a lot of ways. One, it was the negative point, of course, is people are still worried. But two, people were ready to get going again. And so... Yes. We went ahead and, you know, I enforced masks and vaccinations because it was my event and I could do what I wanted to. but we ran it, and I was most nervous about getting the numbers that I needed, not having done this before. But, you know, when you're hitting Facebook and Reddit and Discord and, you know, any other outlet that I can think, we were putting up flyers around town, those kinds of things, just keep hitting them over and over again. We got our numbers without too much problem, really. We got a full 41 players. Yeah.
And how far in advance of the game did you sell out with your tickets?
Yeah, oh gosh. Well, I think I opened up the tickets to a small group of people that I really wanted to play, selfishly, like 4 months in advance. And then I opened it to the general public 3 months in advance. And I think we sold out in about a month and a half. So, you know,
That's pretty good.
I was working pretty hard at it. But yeah. It's definitely doable if you put in the time. You can get a full squad of people, so...
Fantastic. Okay, yep. Well, we will loop back to that in a second. So other than science in UN, were there any other big changes?
Yeah, we basically rewrote the war game too, because the rules were just really hard to follow as someone who is not familiar with that aspect of it. So we just kind of came up with a strength system for the UFOs and for ground units and how ground units moved around. There is an argument to be said, like how many changes to Watch the Skies does it take before it's no longer Watch the Skies? I would argue that the passion and the theme is so strong that it's going to take a lot before it does not become Watch the Skies. But you know, other folks may disagree with me. But so we kind of gave those some rules that we could all understand and that my control team was comfortable with, because of course, well, maybe I didn't say this earlier, but my control team, they'd never even played a mega game. So I had five guys along with me who were gamers, yes, but had never played a mega game like this before. So it was new to all of us when we ran it.
Yes, your build-up of control team was going to be my next question.
Yeah.
Did you have friends that you knew for those things, or did you look for volunteers to help you control? How did you manage that?
Yeah, they were all friends. I run a game group here in Louisville with a bunch of friends that I've kind of, you know, in quotes, collected over the years. Interestingly, when you're an adult and you move to a new city, you sort of have to learn how to make friends all over again. So it's sort of a skill that I've developed over the past 15 years. And so I've got this really amazing group of guys who we play games with. And, you know, they put their trust in me and I drug them along for... Now, I kept saying the words, dragging them along for the ride, but, you know, they had an amazing time and they were really grateful. They, you know, as the runner, you're supposed to provide your control team with goodies. And I did. I gave them a bunch of goodies for helping me. But they ended up buying me a bottle of whiskey too. So they were grateful for it. Yeah.
They can't have had too bad a time then.
Exactly.
And I'm sure all the dragging you did was fully consensual and that was all absolutely fine, I'm sure.
I think so, yes.
No coercion there at all. Are your friends role players? Do they have any kind of experience DMing or GMing or anything like that?
Very little, really. Yeah, one of them has got some role play experience. He's been playing D&D for many years, but the rest of them were just board gamers. One was a war gamer, so I put him in charge of the war map. And the guy that was the biggest, in quotes, board gamer, he and I sort of developed the science game together, and he was the one that came up with I wanted it in an auction of some sort, and he came up with the specifics, so I kind of just let him run with it, and it worked wonderfully. So yeah, we're just a bunch of gamers.
Amazing. Okay. So other than just the small changes you made to science, UN,
control team,
changing the rules for the maps, was there anything else you felt the need to change?
We wrote a new story for the aliens. We did, okay. But we didn't actually change the rules for the aliens very much at all. We added a couple of mechanics just to fit in with the story that we were telling, but mostly kept it as is, just in case anybody had seen the infamous YouTube video.
Yes, that is a slight problem. Yeah. Are you willing to talk about the story of Uranians?
Absolutely. No. Well, I've run it twice now, and I'm probably not going to run it now for another year or two. And even if we did, we'd probably change it because most people, everybody that's played it knows the story now. But we did it, we kind of set it up like a three-part story, like a three acts almost, whereby it began as the aliens' homeworld was dying. They sent the queen off with a group of people, a group of the aliens. They ended up crash landing on Earth somewhere. Their systems were down. And then these were the aliens that were trying to find their queen and rescue her and then do something. So from the original Watch the Skies, they have all these mechanics on creating terror and using that to, with the humans, to distract them from their dodgy dealings. But essentially in the main game, they're pacifists. So I sort of heavily hinted that their queen would not appreciate them using a massive amount of violence. But in order to distract them a little bit, because I wanted them to focus on their story with the queen, and then once they found the queen, you know, they had to sort of, you know, revive her. And then the third act was, well, what do you do now? Like, do you set off in ships and go look somewhere else? Do you set up shop here on Earth? Do you, you know, mind control a nation and have them as your puppets, you know? And so that's here's the role play, go for it. You've had 2/3 of the game to get up to speed, form those relationships, see how the wind's blowing, and then act 3 is, all right, your time to shine. And it works really nicely in a mega game when you've got three acts like that, I think.
Yeah, that's amazing. There's a very common trait you see with new players that it happens in the Shut Up and Sit Down video where they suddenly realize, yes. I think it's about around the flexibility of the agents that, hang on, we're not playing a board game here. Mm-hmm. There aren't set rules for everything. We can start doing what we want. Mm-hmm. Did you see that when you were playing a game with basically 100% new players? Did you see kind of waves of realization coming over the room? Did a lot of people get it all kind of at the same time? Or
Not at the same time, certainly, but many people did at different moments. And my favorite moment was a good friend of mine who was playing the chief scientist for, I can't remember now, France. No, it wasn't France. It was India. Yeah, it was the chief scientist for India. And they had, we had given them a live alien appeared on one of the science tracks. And it was like a big reveal. We had this built in about 1/3 of the way through, that they've been bidding on all these little construction materials, and all of a sudden a live alien appears. And they're like, oh my gosh. So they're all fighting to be the ones to own this so they can do all kinds of experiments on this live alien. And when you got this alien, we opened up a new section of the tech tree that was like, hey, look at all this new cool stuff you can do that nobody else can do. And the very first thing on that tech tree is habitation for the alien. But you could skip over it and look at the cool stuff down the road, which is like, you know, alien speech and, you know, alien biology technologies and all those things. Well, of course, he wants to go for the cool stuff and he just ignores the habitation. So a turn later, we take his live alien away and give him a dead alien in its place. We're like, hey, by the way, you didn't look after your alien well enough and now he's dead. And he was like, well, I've just done a deal with Great Britain about this live alien. I was like, oh, I'm very sorry. It's like, well, what do I do? It's like, I don't know. What are you going to do? And I can see him like mulling it over in his head. I was like, just tell him whatever you want. This is your time to shine, you know, tell him that this is the deal. And just, you know, and he's like, I could see the cogs turning in his head. Anyway, I went and spoke to him later and he was like, I just sold it. I just went through the deal just like, and then I handed it over to him. We kind of ran away. And later on, he sort of chases him down. It's like, what's this? It's like, did you kill that alien? No, it was magic. Just the way I could just see the cogs turning that there was an option to betray him. You know, we hadn't written any rules around anything like this. But it's like, you know, that's what happens when you do it in science. Things happen. And so that was a really fun moment for me as a control to see him embrace this scenario that he put himself in.
So that was your running your first game.
Yes.
Had you intended it to be a one and done, or had you gone into this thinking you want this to be a new mega gaming group? You want this to be a regular thing? What was your thought process there?
Well, you just never know how it's going to go. Of course. Luckily, we have Gen Con just 2 hours away from where we are here in Louisville. So, and I knew that made enough noise on the Discord channels that Peter and Noah from the Mega Game Coalition sort of approached me and said, hey, we know you've been running this in Louisville. Do you want to run this at Gen Con too? I'm like, okay, sure. But back to your original question, we didn't know how it was going to go. We didn't know how much fun people were going to have, if they were willing to do it again. But I sent a post-game survey and it was overwhelmingly positive. And I even asked, like, how many times per year would you guys be willing to do something like this? And, you know, some people were saying, oh, you know, 4 times. And, well, geez, I don't know if I can quite manage 4 times. But it was really endearing to hear that people love your game so much that they want to repeat and repeat. So we have plans next year I have plans. Like I said, I'm dragging them along. I have plans next year to run 3 games. But this past year, we ran at locally in March, and then I ran the same game, a carbon copy of it, at Gen Con in August this year.
Did you make any modifications based on the first run for the second run, or did you feel like it all went fine?
The biggest change I made was I cut the income in half across the board.
Right.
People were absolutely flush with cash by the end of the first run. You know, how do you balance a mega game? I don't know. Right. And so it felt very brazen, but I just cut everything in half and made things more expensive. And people still had plenty of money, so my fears were unfounded. But that was the biggest change. Mostly everything else was exactly the same because it was so successful. We kind of formalized the end science game as well a little bit so that we weren't scrambling quite as much on the day. But yeah, that was basically a carbon copy, essentially.
And the end state of the two games, did they all pan out in a similar way, or were they vastly different to each other?
They were very different because of the groups we were playing with. You know, we played locally with a group of people that didn't even know what Mega Game was. And then at Gen Con, I was playing with people who absolutely know what Mega Game is and have most people had played before, if not having played Watch the Skies before. We sold out within seconds on the Gen Con website. Yeah. And it was interesting. I almost doubled the price for the Gen Con run and I still, you know, sold out in seconds with a waitlist as long as my arm. So it just shows you the demand for it if you can find the right group over here.
Did you manage to get an idea of how experienced the player base were? Did you do any kind of like surveys of the group at all? Or?
And we did an informal raise your hand kind of thing at the beginning, and it was you know, at least 80% of people had knew and maybe even played 1 or 2 or 3 before. So yeah, massively different. So the way that the game shook out was the military game was way more aggressive. We had a group of one team that came to us at the beginning of the day and said, can I talk to your chief science, to the science control? Like, okay, this is weird. The game hadn't even started yet. We were still setting up. And they wanted a kaiju to appear, which not really my thing, but I kind of had to let you know, it's the player's game, and I had to accept that. And so they had this whole thing where they were firing nukes off into the Japanese oceans, hoping that something would rise. And I'm like, okay, you know, if they want something to rise, we can have it rise, and then it's going to start smashing all your cities. I don't know what they expected to happen, but it kind of made for a fun kind of last turn madness. We had a two rises of the kaiju. The guy that was controlling the military game was very charismatic and big role-playing game guy, and he was just a volunteer that wanted to play, and so he kind of ran with that, and I was like, okay, I'm gonna be hands off here, you have fun with it. And so they did. The experiences with the UN was really fun. Right before the last turn, we had someone come to us and say, hey, I want to blow up the UN. Like, hold that thought. So, and then at one point we had and then right before that, somebody drug along their prime minister. I think it was the British Prime Minister. They sort of drug him along to the UN. And because where we were situated, we didn't have a room like we did when we ran it in March. So we said that if anybody stands up from their chair. So before we got to that UN, I made sure he had a chair. And what was hilarious, the best part about this was, you know, you've got the UN and you've got this prime minister who was just kind of along for the ride thinking, how did I get myself into this mess? And every time someone tried to walk over to the UN to ask a question, half the UN would turn around and shout, no! Because they were just so fearful these, like, in quotes, bombs were going to explode and destroy everything that they didn't want anybody even near the table. It was pretty fabulous the way they embraced that. So, but outside of those things, it ran just as smooth and was pretty typical of a way any Watch This Guys runs, I suppose.
Were there any other big differences you noticed running the game in a convention setting as opposed to running it as in a local setting?
Oh, my ownership and my control freak in me had to be more hands off.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you have different stipulations, and I was running it with the Mega Game Coalition, which, for those of you who don't know, basically just a bunch of people like me that either run things locally or just get together at Gen Con and some of the big conventions to run things. So, you know, it's done like a committee in a lot of ways, and there's one person that talks to Gen Con that does all the negotiating, and then there's, you know, you've got to set the price, and you've got to go through the Gen Con systems, and you've got to get the right room, and you're kind of limited to the materials and things. You know, there's all kinds of things that go into a con, and I think you've talked about this before on your podcast, but from my perspective, I just didn't have as much control, which I just I just had to wash my hands off, I suppose, and just go with the flow. Yeah,
just embrace and go along for the ride.
So that's it. Yeah.
And here's a question for you then. Are you glad you did it that way around? Are you glad you ran one locally first and then did the convention? Or do you think it would have been better to do it the other way around?
Oh, that's a great question. Absolutely doing it on my own first, because it got my confidence up.
Yeah.
And if I had just been this random dude who came to a convention with all these folks that had run Mega Games before, the pressure would have been on big time. As it was, I just walked in there on top of the world because we just had this amazing run in March. So just from a confidence perspective. And also, when working with Noah and Peter from the Mega Game Coalition, they have this amazing chart that sort of tells you the kind of things that you can charge for a mega game based on the complexity and the number of players and how many times you've run it before and how fleshed out it is and how play tested it is and that kind of stuff. And so, you know, even though it was Watch the Skies that's been run 1,000 times before, I'd made enough modifications to it that I just didn't know how well it was going to run on the day. So it would have been a different conversation with those guys at the beginning had I have gone to the con before running it on my own. Yeah.
And was that your only contribution to a Gen Con and Mega Game this year?
No, I ran one, controlled one, and played one, which was
a real sucker for punishment.
Yeah, it was a lot to do, but it was the reason I did this. Well, run one, of course, we've talked about that just because I just wanted to and wanted to give to the community. I wanted to control something that I could potentially run here locally. So I had played Den of Wolves twice before, but had never seen behind the scenes. I'd bought all the materials, and the materials for Den of Wolves are excellent, but there's nothing like hands-on experience. So I worked with Noah to help him run Den of Wolves on the Sunday morning with the goal of running it here in Louisville next year. And then I played one, and this I played Peter's design, which is called As Thou Commands. Orcs, goblins, elves, and dwarves are all included. He did an As Thou Commands the day before, which was a historical version, which is probably closer to Game of Thrones, that kind of thing. But we did the fantasy edition. And I wanted to play in one because I had no idea what As Thou Commands was. It wasn't, my intention was not because I was going to run it later, although that's always a possibility. I just wanted to see a different mega game, one that's maybe not quite so well known, and to experience it. And it was fabulous. Very different from the other two.
So were you playing with your game runner / designer hat on and looking at things and thinking, oh, that's nice, I'm going to borrow how he's done that? Or were you just there to just immerse yourself in the game?
Mostly number two, but you cannot help but pick his apart a little bit as you're playing it. You know, he had some UI stuff going on. His user interface needed a little work. But, you know, I think he was the first to admit that after the day, how people sort of struggled with that a little bit. The gameplay itself was, you know, wonderful. He did a really good job with the way it flowed. And I think you've had him on here before, right, Peter? And talking about
yes,
this one.
Yeah, we've had, I don't know if we've done a full interview with him, but he's definitely contributed to a few sections over the years, so yes. Absolutely.
Yeah, I seem to remember him saying something about how this is, you know, kind of disguised, it's a disguised LARP in a lot of ways. I can see that from the way that things played out, and I was totally okay with that. I still had a lot of fun, but some of the folks at my table when we were playing it from our kingdom struggled a little bit with the sort of open-endedness of it a little bit. They needed something to focus on. The mini game that we were playing was their focus, and they weren't really stepping outside of that to think about what the big ramifications and the big story and the big role playing could be outside of that little room that we were in, the little area we were playing in. So I had a fantastic time as a designer and a runner. You know, I kind of ran with it and sort of took his ideas and created my own story around that, and I sort of ended up creating a civil war, which not really much attention, but was hilarious. I basically ended up playing the bad guy, which I'm happy to do because, of course, I've got a British accent surrounded by all these Americans who think that.
Well, yeah, you're the natural choice,
right? I was happy to play into that stereotype, so it was really fun. Yeah.
It's a thin line between a LARP and a mega game, mm-hmm. is the possibly controversial topic. And if you want to read some interesting articles on that, look at our feature on our blog recently, Why LARPs Are Better Than Mega Games, and the very quickly submitted follow-up, Why Mega Games Are Better Than LARPs. We think we may have to devote a side of the blog entirely to that because we've had quite a few counterpoints to both blogs submitted again to us. So I think we can just keep that running.
And that was me that wrote that, Harrison. Did you know that?
Yeah, I did indeed. And yet we have quite a list building up. So coming in, if you're listening to this and you'd like to have a crack yourself, but yes, it's an interesting, we really do need to do a proper podcast episode on it at some point, because it's, I think the reason it's created such a buzz is everybody reads one of those articles and is screaming at the screen before they've got to the end of it, because it's one of those things that's very, I mean, even the definition of a mega game is something we've battered around for years and years, unnecessarily so. I think it's definitely something that could do with a full podcast episode on. So we maybe won't touch on it too much here, but the idea that some of the people in your team were struggling to grok the open world nature of the game, do you think that in your position as someone who's gamed in the UK and gamed in America, do you think that's a regional thing, or do you think that's more kind of a board gamer coming into a more open-ended game thing?
Oh, it's absolutely a board gamer. It's not a regional thing. It's a board gamer trying to work out what the rules are for a mega game and a LARP and improv, which is a really hard thing to get across unless you've seen it happen firsthand.
Yeah.
You could teach people a little bit, but you have to see it happen before you realize, oh, this is how it works. On my table that particular day, I was the only one who had done it. And some of their feedback that they gave me at the end was, oh, I wish I'd have done more. It's like, don't worry, we all feel that way the first time.
It's a very universal feeling, isn't it, coming out your first game, that, oh, I realize all the things I could have done. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So I just want to quickly loop back to something you mentioned in passing there. You said that you had obviously, you played Den of Wolves before you ran Watch the Skies. Had you got the materials for both? Was there a decision that you made as to whether you ran Den of Wolves or Watch the Skies as your first game?
So I only had the materials for Watch the Skies, and I wanted to run Watch the Skies specifically because it's like the mega game, right? And what better way to introduce the hobby to people by playing the one that the hobby is famous for, even though it's a little bit, even our version is going to be a little bit different. But as much as I love Den of Wolves, I don't know, I would say it's way easier to run Den of Wolves because it's a lot more mechanical and there's less things that are going on and you need a smaller control team. I would say if you can run Watch the Skies first, because it will teach you a huge amount, probably more than Den of Wolves. Den of Wolves is, you know, there's an argument to be said that it's just a giant board game, and that's a reasonable argument. I'm not saying it's a perfectly sane argument, but there is an argument to be said that it is just a large board game. Whereas Watch the Skies, because there are so many distinct different roles, it teaches you so much more about the hobby in general.
Interesting. It's an interesting take. I've not heard that decision made for those reasons before. Very interesting. So you had the option to run either or, really, and you decided Watch the Skies for those reasons.
Yeah. And, you know, if I'm going to introduce a whole bunch of new people to the hobby, you know, it's instantly, the theme is it's instantly easy to get a hold of and to get your brain around because it's not that far away from the real world. Whereas Den of Wolves have you seen Battlestar Galactica? No. Well, let me explain this to you then. So it's a very different conversation that you're having with people.
Yeah, absolutely. I would really like to run a tally at some point to see if Den of Wolves or Watch the Skies has been run more one over the other. I think it's probably closer than most people would think. But I think regardless of how many times Den of Wolves has been run and how many reports you can point people towards or people talking about playing the game and having an amazing time, the fact that the video exists of Watch the Skies, I think still gives it a massive advantage over anything else.
Yeah.
Because particularly when you're appealing to board gamers who are used to watching a video of their favorite YouTuber, board game person, or a TikTok or a Twitch or whatever, watching someone play a game and saying, yes, I want to play that. It's still the only one that you can really do that for. You can say to people, watch this video about Watch the Skies. These things are called mega games. Here are some of the mega games. But if you want to play that one, you want to play the game that you see someone else playing on a video, it's still basically the only one that really exists in that way, in my opinion.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'd love to see someone as high profile as Shut Up and Sit Down do a Den of Wolves version, because it would have the same effect. It would be easy to point to. It would tell an amazing story, and there would be great promotional material.
Yes, absolutely. I think it's just such a massive advantage it has over anything else. And it's the certain type of person who wants to watch a game being played before committing to it themselves. And, you know, committing to a mega game is such a massive thing compared to buying a board game and trying to get friends around to play or something. It's a lot more. So it's a better way of getting people in the door in that way, I think. So much like LARPs versus mega games, I don't think we can conclusively prove one way or the other that one is a better first game than the other, but I think it's an interesting conversation to have, I think.
Yeah.
Okay, so you'd done your played one, ran one, modified one, one at Gen Con, and then what was your next step after that? Did you have plans, or did you come away from Gen Con with a million things bouncing around in your head and ideas? How did you finish the con? Or did you just go home and sleep for a week?
Yeah.
That's probably what I would have done.
That one first. But so we're going to run Den of Wolves in March of next year. So that's definitely happening. I have not released the date yet. The tickets are not available just yet, but they will be by the end of this year. So that's definitely happening here in Louisville. So if you are close by in a neighboring state or so, we'll be doing it here. I am also, I would say, 75% of the way through a design of my own that I did from the ground up, which I am planning on running next summer here in Louisville. And then all being well from that, I will run the same thing again in Gen Con. That's my current plan. Who knows what the future will hold, but that's my plan if you ask me today.
Okay, and are you planning on doing that just as yourself? Are you planning on trying to get a local kind of mega game group officially formed?
Well, so official is an interesting word there, Harrison. So my games group, the Dukes of Highland, I have stolen our name to promote mega games here locally and at Gen Con, so I'm going to keep using that. Nobody else seemed to mind that's part of my regular game group. In fact, they were quite impressed that we had a logo, and we've got merch as well, which is really funny to me.
Oh, well, if you have a logo alone, I think that makes it official, but a logo and merch most definitely puts it well over the line.
So we'll keep running under that banner, and I will drag them along to help me control all the things locally next year. And then we'll go through Gen Con just like normal and just get volunteers just using the same the same methods that we have been doing for Gen Con over the past several years for that. Yeah.
If people are listening who are local to you and want to offer to help control or to get involved in the running, are you open to those volunteers and so forth to help you in your local games?
Sure, absolutely. Now, for Den of Wolves, I won't need help because Den of Wolves can be run with such a small control group. I've already got two of my friends signed up for that, which is nice because it allows the folks that have not played before to play in my control team from this past year. They get to play next year. But my new design, I don't know how much control I will need yet. Not quite decided on that. So possibly, absolutely, yeah, if you're interested, I'm on Discord and around the interwebs.
And are you in a position to talk much about designing your own game without giving too much away? Or is it a bit of a tricky position where it is at the moment?
Oh, no, I'm happy to. It's, like I said, it's about 75% complete, which feels really good right now. The theme, the working title is called Gods of the Ancient World. It is a Romans versus Greeks kind of game whereby the gods are hovering on Mount Olympus causing mayhem to the mortals, as all the good Greeks and Romans legends tell us. And it will be a faction versus faction battle going on between those two groups. So we're going to sort of beef up the historical Greeks a little bit so that they can compare with the Romans. So they'll be, you know, in quotes, balanced against each other. And then on each faction, you'll have some leader, like an emperor or a king or something. And then there will be different regions in those locations. Each of those regions will have a priest and a military commander and a governor and a senator and someone to help build up the region with buildings and resources and that kind of stuff. Meanwhile, there will be a group of aliens, excuse me, not aliens, gods that are playing their own game that occasionally will come down to the mortals and, like, you know, destroy entire cities and make mortals fall in love and, you know, give someone invulnerability except for their ankle. You know, those kinds of things. So that is the theme. And I would say we are pretty close to being done. I'll tell you that the bit I'm most proud of is the way that the gods and the mortals interact with. So everybody, every turn, all the mortals will get a prayer token and they get to put that in a piggy bank of a god. And that prayer token is colored for their faction so that when all the prayer tokens have been added to the piggy banks, they are all counted and each god knows exactly how many people have been praying for them from each faction. And aggressively or not, you know, because the gods are the same, they've just got different names. So you've got like Mars and Ares, depending on which is the same god and they can go by both names, but you know, one's Greek and one's Roman. And so if Mars/Ares sees a whole bunch of blue tokens, he's like, oh, well, maybe I should help the Greeks out a little bit more this turn because they're obviously struggling in their wars and the priests are telling them that the people have been prayed to be more. And not only are the gods playing both sides, they're also competing against each other. So they're hoping for more prayer tokens so they can go up their own rankings. So the gods are going to have this sort of really interesting game and the mortals are not really going to have a clue what the gods are up to. And it's going to feel like the gods are selfish and, you know, do things on that without really understanding what the gods are doing, just like in the legends, you know. So that's fantastic. That's the way it's going to play out. Yeah,
that sounds really good. And is there a mechanical bonus for the gods in game for more people praying for them than the others, or is it just simply bragging rights?
Yeah, they're going to get more power. They could do cooler stuff. So, and definitely bragging rights. That by the end of the game, Zeus may not be the number one guy anymore. It might be somebody else. You know, it'd be really funny if Hera was already suddenly the leader of the gods because people have prayed to her way more than they've prayed to Zeus, and his power has been diminished as a result.
Yep. Amazing. Yeah, that sounds very, very good. Okay. Any other particular thoughts on your design process you'd like to talk about?
Well, Harrison, you could read all about it over at dukesofhighland.net. I have been blogging about my journey and to see why I have made certain decisions and the kind of things I've been thinking about. And it's been very... I've been on the Discord many times asking for advice, particularly about some of the elements that are not my strong suits. For example, the military game is something that is the least interesting to me, but still integral to this kind of game. So I didn't want to do it an injustice by just tacking it on. So I reached out to the design community and got some really good ideas. But yeah, it's all on my website and, you know, that's where you can find out why it works the way it is.
Links will be to all of these things in the podcast description, as always. So the last thing I wanted to talk to you then is the Mega Game Coalition Mentor Program.
Yeah.
Are you able to give people the brief overview of that before we get into it if they've not heard of it before?
Absolutely. So it's basically brand new. So they may not have heard of it before, except for a few pings on the Discord channels. So after Gen Con, we kind of regrouped as the coalition is a group of organizers. We regrouped and talked about what the Mega Game Coalition may look like going forwards. We've had some turnover pre and post pandemic. Looks a little different from what I understand. I am a post pandemic, in quotes, hire. Not that we're getting paid for it, but I'm a post pandemic baby. And so we're talking about what we might be doing going forwards. Some of that is how we organize Gen Con going forwards and what other conventions the Mega Game Coalition may have a presence in. There was plans to be part of Origins this year, but they all fell through for reasons that I don't quite understand because I've not been part of that. So, you know, they'll be reevaluating which conventions are the right ones for us to be in, where we have to sort of spend our time and effort. But for me, the thing I'm most passionate about is local groups. You know, I kind of created our group from nothing with, you know, very little assistance because not many people are doing it over here. And so I learned the hard way a lot of things, and there's no way that you're going to grow the hobby just by doing 3 events at Gen Con a year. I mean, we did more than that, but you know, that's my exaggeration. So you have to sort of build from the ground up, like a grassroots kind of effort. And the only way you're going to do that is if you can provide people support from experienced designers and runners and organizers and planners and marketers and all those kinds of people that it takes to make a successful game group be able to put on a mega game. So I proposed that we run this mentor program, and they were like, yeah, that sounds cool, have at it. So I'm like, okay, cool, thanks guys. So I kind of put pen to paper then and thought what this might look like, as I've been part of mentor programs in you know, my real world, in the corporate world here in the States, and sort of took some ideas from that and said, well, what's it going to take? Well, the first thing, you need volunteers as mentors, and you need to advertise to people to get mentees, and you've got to match them to their particular needs. So if someone, you've got to work out what their goals are, and they might say, well, I want to design a game and run it 4 times in a year. You're like, whoa, that's a really great goal. It's lofty, but if you're dedicated, we can make this happen. Here are the kind of things you need to be thinking about. And so, yeah, so we've just started, and I thought what we would do is do this in, like, you know, 6-month chunks to reevaluate at the end to see what needs to be changed. As any good thing, when you create it, it's going to go through different changes, and I am not opposed to changing something because it needs to be changed.
An ongoing creative process, I believe, is the way to describe that.
That is exactly right. Yeah. So there are about 6 mentors right now, and we have about 9 mentees, folks from all kinds of different backgrounds, mostly North American based, because that's 2 of our mentors are UK based, which is fun. And I'm mostly drawing on those guys for their design abilities because, you know, you've got a lot more experience with mega games in the UK than we do over here. So I'd rather put these aspiring designers with people that have got a lot of experience designing mega games. If someone's saying they want to run at a con, well, we've got people that can help with that. You know, for people that are doing sort of the kind of things that I am doing, well, I'm going to be a mentor for that kind of person that wants to create a mega game group from the ground up. So yeah, that's the goal. It's still early days, and we will do a big, like, in quotes, advertising push in about 6 months to see who would be interested then. But of course, if anybody's interested right now, we would be happy to try and match people, including mentors. I would assume that from your audience, Harrison, that you would have more mentors than mentees, but maybe I'm mistaken. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, yeah, you never know. You never know. And so just to be clear, you are offering mentorship in every aspect of running mega games, whether that's designing them, setting up a game from scratch, running at cons, how to get your control team working, and all that sort of stuff. You're hoping to be able to offer mentorship for every single step. It's not just simply about writing mega games. It's about everything to do with running mega games. Was that be accurate?
Oh, that's absolutely accurate. Yeah. In fact, I might argue that it's more difficult to run a game than it is design a game. I mean, every board game that I've ever met has always had desires to create his own board game, and you know, some of those people have put pen to paper, and you get on something like gamecrafter.com and you can throw a board game together. Now, I don't know what the quality is going to be like, but it is way different to put on a mega game and all the logistics and things that you have to consider, particularly, you know, even even component creation is something that is it's very difficult if you don't even know where to begin. So you're from all of those phases. And it might be that in the mentor program, you might start with one mentor that's got a set of skills in design and then transition to someone that more suits your design, your ideas for putting on that mega game, whether it's someone that's really intimate with cons or creating something from the ground up or tacking on to someone else's game group, whatever that might look like. So with the quality of folks that we've got in the mega game community, we've got some really good mentors right now.
Fantastic. I'm just adding to my spicy topics list here. Running a mega game is harder than designing a mega game.
So ooh, I'm going to think that was
back
a bit
to that one day.
Yeah, maybe. Well, maybe I shouldn't have said that. Between words, maybe.
But I think that sounds incredible. I've most definitely had, I don't think I've met a mega gamer so far who doesn't have a mega game idea in them somewhere or another. So I completely agree with you there. But yes, I've also had conversations with people about how one of the most frustrating things to me is the amount of time that you find yourself struggling with something or you're having an issue with something and then you find out later on that such and such is actually really good at that or such and such has done that before, and having a forum where you can go in and say this is something I'm struggling with and expect that there's going to be someone there who can say actually I've got experience at that, let me tell you how I can help you, I think it's a really good thing.
Yeah, and just people to point folks in the direction of resources. You know, there are already a bunch of blogs out there, but if you don't know where they are, they're essentially worthless. So just having someone say, you need a control team. Here's what you need to think about when you're looking for people to help you control. And here's a blog post that I wrote about this, 6 months ago or whatever it is. So just having people that can point you in those directions too.
Yeah, amazing. I think absolutely. Realistically, we are a hobby with a relatively small amount of man time and manpower behind it, or person time. So anything that prevents duplication of effort or helps people, kind of like get a leg up or helps pull people up is invaluable in my opinion. So I think it all sounds incredible. And I wish you all luck with it. And I don't know what mentorship I could offer other than it's a bit of a niche ability to make a mega game podcast, but I suppose maybe offer that one up.
Maybe. So I want to just call back to something I mentioned earlier about making games easier to run. One of the first questions that one of the folks that I am a mentor for asked me was, what game do I run? I was like, oh, what a great question. And you and I have talked about this a little bit today with Watch the Skies and Den of Wolves, but if those are not interesting to somebody, or I think he felt like they'd been overdone in a lot of ways, which is a fine argument, but if you're in a new location, I don't think it's overdone because those folks have never seen these before. Either way, you have to be passionate about the game that you're going to put on. And if you're not passionate about those two, well, what else is there out there? So I've been thinking a lot about, my experience is limited, and what does a good mega game, in quotes, in a box look like? Well, Den of Wolves is an excellent example of one that's put together that's got really good production instructions. The game instructions are one thing, but production instructions are an entirely different kettle of fish.
Yes, definitely.
So next time I talk to the Mega Game Coalition guys, I'm going to propose that we do one of my real life jobs is I'm a data steward for data, which doesn't sound very exciting, but our database tables have a certification with them to show you what the metadata looks like. So how good the data is and how you can trace back where the data comes from. And so we certify whether things are bronze, silver, or gold based on the amount of documentation behind it. Why don't we do something similar for mega games and their production? Not saying anything about the quality of the game, but does your game have a detailed list of components? How do you create those components? How big a control team do you need? When do you introduce this story element? So just questions like that. And I think a sort of a bronze, silver, and gold thing would be really helpful. So you can see, Watch the Skies, in my opinion, out the box is kind of a bronze, but a Den of Wolves is kind of a gold tier because it's so good and helps you step through things. But that's my experience. I don't know anything about these other games, and I don't know what it takes to run them. So I would love for us to be able to review these as we're running them and be able to say, this is a silver, and if you just do X, Y, and Z, I almost said Z then. I was living in the States too long. If you do X, Y, and Z, then you could get this to a gold. And it's not. It's not saying that it's not good to be a bronze or a silver. It's just us saying to you, we want you to succeed and we want you to advertise your game to other people so that they can enjoy it as well. They're just not going to be able to do it if you don't have these things in place. And so here's how we can help you get to a gold standard so that you can share it with the world and, you know, maybe make a few bucks from it. So that's my big goal.
That sounds great. Are you planning on kind of producing, I don't know what the correct term would be, but a documentation, kind of a list of what you think is required to make it gold, silver, or bronze? Yeah. Or are you going to do it case by case?
I think we would have something standard, but it would require a whole bunch of us, not just, you know, I've got a few ideas, but there is a lot more knowledge out there than just my input. So I would expect a whole bunch of people to weigh in on what makes a good game, what makes a good production game. I was just listening to the Australian guys on their podcast in talking about It Belongs in a Museum.
Yes, yeah.
And they were saying that they really struggled. They loved the theme, but when they purchased the materials, they asked for they were given a discount because they struggled to put it together in a package that they could up to the standards of their game group. I was like, that's exactly what I'm talking about. Like those guys, the Australian folks that ran it, I think it was in Melbourne, they had to do the work on their side, and I think they fed it back to the designer, from what I understand. I'd love to know what state this game's in, because it sounds like a fabulous game. I'd love to run it myself. But I don't know if it's a bronze, or if it's a silver, or if it's gold. I would like to think that the Melbourne guys sort of turned it into a gold. But again, I don't know what their documentation looks like. So that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. I cannot consider running something unless I know that it's feasible without putting in a year's worth of work just to get it up to a particular standard.
Yeah, absolutely. And at the end of the day, people are selling a product and people are buying a product. And people, I don't think it's completely unreasonable to say that people expect a certain level of what they're purchasing. If you're sending money to a designer to buy a game to run and they're sending you something that in its form as it is can't be run or needs to be changed or whatever, that should probably be known up front. Or, you know, someone should be aware of that. So I think it's a really sensible idea.
And so much of a mega game too is in the designer's head. And so you are the designer running your own game, it's way easier than if you're picking this documentation up from scratch and going, what did the designer mean to do in this point? I have no idea. So that kind of thing, just to help spell those details out for future organizers, I think it would be really helpful.
Yeah. Well, going back to one of the first things we talked about, how when Jim Wallman was writing Watch the Skies, he probably never even considered that somebody would be reading through this and about to put it on, having never actually played it. So yeah, there's only so much you can just pull out of the air, and you know, you can only rely on people's experience so much. I think you should expect it to be there in the materials, really. So yeah, that seems like a really good thing and a great way to, what's the phrase here, add a level of professionalism, I suppose, to the hobby, or a certain kind of level that people can expect when purchasing games.
I mean, that's what organizers do when they run a game. So when I was building up my components for Den of Wolves, which I'm going to run next year, I went to Staples, which is a local store over here, big chain in the US, and got all my maps printed out. And when I went to Gen Con and I saw their Den of Wolves maps, I was like, oh man, those are really nice. Where do you get these from? And one of the folks in the Mega Game Coalition, he owns a print shop. And I was like, nice. Oh man, can you print me off these copies too? Because these look way nicer than my copies. Because I want to put on a really good professional production for the folks that I run it for, because they're going to pay me for an experience that's got to be half decent. And I want to do as best job I can for it.
And if you can make it, particularly if it's their first mega game experience, if you can make it as awesome and fun and enjoyable and epic as possible, then you've got a significantly better chance that they're going to come back for their second and third and fourth and onwards. So I think it's definitely something to aim for.
Yep.
Okay, fantastic. Well, that all sounds really exciting. And if anybody would like to get in touch with you to discuss any of these things, what's your preferred form of communication? How would you like people to find you on the interwebs?
Well, I am not a social media butterfly. I try and avoid them, those things, because they are generally full of scum and villainy. But I can be found on Discord. And so my moniker is PANI, but I'm on I'm fairly active on the Meg Game Coalition and the Meg Games International and the MegaCon Discord sites. Or you can email me. So as I've mentioned before, my website is dukesofhighland.net. On there, you will find no links to social media websites, but you will find a big box that says, please give me your email address, because I can shoot out things in small doses to say, hey, this is when my game's coming up, and here's my blog posts in case you're interested. Hey, grab some merch too while you're there. But seriously, my email list is kind of my, I look after those emails close to my chest, and you can just email me at dukesofhighlandglobal@gmail.com.
Okay, fantastic. Anything else that you would like to mention before we sign off?
I don't think so. I'm just sort of excited for next year. You know, March seems a long way away.
Before you know it.
Yeah, maybe. So I'm super excited to put on Den of Wolves. Hopefully my design will be a little closer to completion by then, so I can run it in, thinking about June, sort of halfway between March and Gen Con. And then I've got to convince the Game Coalition guys to let me run it at Gen Con as well. So yeah, look for me at Gen Con if you go to that next year.
Great. Well, thank you very much for joining me this evening, or this afternoon for you. It's been a really good talk. And hopefully if anyone has been inspired by anything we've spoken about here, get in touch, get part of this mentor program, or just pitch some ideas, or start your own mega gaming group. Why not?
Absolutely.
And if you do, let us know. We'd love to hear how it goes.
Thanks, Harrison.
My thanks to Tony for joining me for that conversation there. I hope you learned some stuff. As always, the links will be in the podcast description for all of the things we've spoken about. There's some great resources there. And as always, please reach out to us if you have any questions or any suggestions for future episodes you'd like to hear here on the channel. And until next time, thank you and goodbye.